Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff, which I'm apparently supposed to introduce that way. This is a show that I'm already tired of coming up with clever ways of introducing, and I'm your host, Margaret Killjoy. And every week, I tell you about the people I have arbitrarily determined as cool. My guest this week is Brody Reed. Brody, how are you doing?
I'm great. You didn't say my full credits or anything, but I'm actually a cool expert. I'm a professor down at the University of Chilhangs and go Cowabungas. And I'm happy to be here with you to judge or whatever it is that we do.
Okay, so at the end of this episode, are you going to tell me, is it like cool or not? Is that the...
Yes.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you throughout the whole episode.
Okay, no, I guess that is why we brought you on. And we've got Sophie on the line as well, who is our producer. Sophie, do you have any new monosyllabic ways to answer the question of how are you doing?
No.
Okay, just checking. Okay, so I'm really excited about this week's episode. Brody, no one warned you what the episode is about, right?
No. No.
Excellent.
I don't like spoilers, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Okay, well, I'm excited about this week's episode because this week I get to say about one of my favorite people that I've ever run across. If you don't think she's cool, I'm going to be very sad. And a bunch of other people too, some of whom are cool. Okay. And I say basically every week that I love these people, and I mean it every week. I love all of my podcasts topics equally. I just love this one a little bit more equally. Because this week, I'm going to tell you a story about some women in Japan about 100 years ago who had a problem. And they had a multitude of problems, like the horrendous treatment of workers and of women and of the Korean subjects of the Japanese Empire. But these women, 10 years apart from each other, they never met. They came up with really similar solutions to their problems. Brody, is there a problem that can't be solved by throwing a bomb at an emperor?
Let me think. Yeah, there's a couple problems. Fracking, that's one. Low wages, that's one. I'm gonna say most problems can't be solved by throwing a bomb at an emperor.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right, well,
It depends on how you look at it, because, I mean, if your problems are caused by the emperor... Listen, I'm pro-bomb choice. I just want to put that out there. Okay. I like blowing stuff up.
Yeah, right. And actually, one of the things that, you know, learning about most history it relates to bombs is that it doesn't actually solve the problem. But you can't fault people for trying. And although if these people had actually succeeded, they might have made the world a better place, almost on the killing Hitler level of good. Because... today, I'm going to talk about two women who tried to introduce the wonders of gunpowder to the divine emperor of Japan. It's the stories of Kano Suga and Kaneko Fumiko, two Japanese women who were sentenced to death for trying to explode parts of the imperial family. And they were both poets, they were both anarchists, and in other ways, they couldn't have been more different from each other. So we're going to start this story where all things start, or at least some anime starts, with the Meiji Restoration.
I see why I was booked for this episode now.
Do you want to explain to the listener why you were probably booked?
Well, I'm a big nerd. I'm a comedian, but I also am a big, I guess, Japanophile. Honestly, I'm a weeb. I have a show called The Dark Weeb. I speak Japanese also, so stuff like that.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, that is why I presented this topic, and people were like,
yeah, now that I know which bomb you're talking about, because first when you said bomb, I was just like, oh, I know two famous ones. And I was just like, those ones are bad. But now that we're talking about anarchists and little bombs, little guys.
Oh, yeah.
Now I'm on board.
No, this actually makes a lot of sense. I hadn't thought about this context. There were some other people who used bombs in very bad ways.
Yeah.
It gets to the indiscriminate part is where it gets.
And
really
a lot
bad.
Of them are good. Some of the most famous bombs are actually Japanese bombs from Mario.
Those are
from there. You know, that one bomb in Akira. Again, bringing it back to anime. Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to imagine all of the bombs that are going to be included today as the little Mario bombs.
Good.
So. Okay, so the Meiji Restoration, which you probably know more about than I do, which is probably good.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to do it justice, right? It's this really big, important thing that happened, the Meiji Restoration. But I don't know actually that much about it. I learn about it in the context of the stuff I do know more about, which is some women who liked the little Mario bombs.
Yeah, essentially, I can give you like a cliff notes. It was this transitional period from around the time when feudal Japan ended, when Japan was unified, there was an era of relative peace and order and stuff like that. And then the Meiji Restoration was kind of getting rid of the samurai class in general, modernizing the country. It brought a lot of good things, economic prosperity, educational prosperity. So people regard it as a good thing. And there's, you know, there's still swords, so it's all good.
Yeah, it is kind of an interesting, I think that's part of the reason people like it aesthetically, is you get the nice, like, there's still swords involved in some of these fights.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then a lot of people, you're right, a lot of people view this as a positive thing. There were a lot of reforms happening at this time.
Yeah, but also kind of a nationalist twinge to it, yeah.
Yeah, and there's this idea that basically the Imperial West was looking to the East. And so Japan was like, okay, depends on who you ask. Either Japan was like, we need to be prepared to defend ourselves from the imperialists in the West. Or Japan was like, we need to join the imperialist West and start doing our own empire. So you get some vestiges of Western liberalism during all this time. You get a cabinet system, you get a constitution, but it's not a democracy. The constitution was a gift from the emperor to the people, and he could change it whenever he wants. And
cool.
yeah, exactly. And it borrowed some stuff from the West, right? But it was also at the same time uniquely and fiercely Japanese. Mm-hmm. But when you introduce capitalism to a country, you also introduce anti-capitalism.
Oh, yeah. That's the sound of me rubbing my palms together. Let's get into it.
And much like the government borrowed some elements from the West and then rooted that in tradition, the anti-capitalists did the same thing. Socialism hits Japan in the late 19th century, and it wasn't long before a ton of these early socialists figure out exactly what kind of socialists they are, which is that they're anarchists. The first introduction to anarchism came from abroad. A lot of it was inspired by people like the industrial workers of the world in the United States, or conversations with Russian philosopher Peter Kropotkin. But it found roots immediately in Japanese history. The Japanese anarchists got really excited about how it tied into horizontal features of village communalism in their history. And in particular, there was this 18th century samurai philosopher guy who didn't like samurai.
Interesting.
Named Ando Shoiki. And he's immediately adopted as a forebearer to the anarchists, like retroactively, because he was this philosopher. He rejected Buddhism and Confucianism. He hated feudalism. He hated bureaucracy and law, and he believed all people were equal. In fact, all people were the same person. And
okay,
yeah, yeah,
let's
I
go.
Know.
I kind of get where he's coming
yeah,
from.
Yeah, no, totally. He's really interesting to me. Okay, so he believes that people should only produce and consume what they needed. But he also mm-hmm. believed that there was going to be a Messiah who is not him, which is a big advantage. If you're going to talk about Messiah stuff, mm-hmm. he's not the Messiah. The Messiah is going to come and usher everyone into a better world.
Yeah, that way you can like kind of spread an idea and you could be like, maybe it's you. And
yeah.
then the audience gets involved, you know?
Yeah, totally. Totally. Maybe it's you who's listening to this right now, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
He also wasn't a lot of fun. He wrote down, and he's kind of making fun of Buddhism when he does this, but he writes down 5 terrible crimes and 10 offenses. Even though he doesn't like law, he writes down his laws. And some of the laws I think are cool laws, like don't become a leader of men. Consuming greedily is bad. We should give up warrior class authority. Establishing borders is a big no-no. But there are also ones like no music and no playing the game Go. So
I can't live without Go, you know what I
yeah,
mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So don't go there. Don't touch my Go.
And I don't know. So this guy where they're excited about Ando. And this isn't about him though, this podcast, because to my knowledge, he didn't explode anyone who needed a good exploding. But onto the stage of early socialism and anarchism steps our first hero, Kano Suga.
Mm-hmm.
She's born in 1881. She's the daughter of a mine operator. We don't know a ton about her life, but the closest we have is that she wrote all these semi-autobiographical stories. She was a fiction writer and a journalist and all this other mm-hmm. stuff. And so she would write these books that are like, here's a story about a daughter of a mine operator who became a socialist, you know? And you're like, oh, okay. And so a lot of what we know about her biography is like, we think she's telling the truth about herself here. It gets messy.
It's like comedy, so I understand.
Yeah, huh? I guess with comedy, you basically tell stories that are like sort of true and present a part of yourself.
Absolutely. We're just very good liars. That's all jokes are.
Okay. And so everything's chill in her early life for a few years. Then when she's 8, her dad's business fails. When she's 10, her mom dies. And then she gets a classic evil stepmother who's really, really bad. I tend to sort of shy away from talking about sexual violence on this show, but when necessary, mm-hmm. I'll bring it up. When Suga is 15, her stepmom convinces a minor to rape her. So this was a kind of formative experience for Suga, as one might imagine. And the socialists at the time were actually really solid feminists, or at least some of them were. And so the first time she runs across socialism is in an essay about how rape victims shouldn't have to carry the guilt of their own rape around, how it's not their fault. This resonates mm-hmm. with her for some obvious reason. And she starts diving in to see what else these folks have to say. When she's 17, she's like, I need to get the hell out of my house. So she marries this random dude she doesn't like, just this random business guy, just to get out of the house and get away from evil stepmom.
Okay, that's not cool, but go
ahead. I know. Like,
we'll see.
Well, it does. She sticks around for a moment. She marries this guy. She lives with him for 3 years.
Yeah. It's act one of her story, obviously.
Yeah. Stepmom leaves the family 3 years later. So Suga's like, mm-hmm. oh, I got to go take care of my dad. I'm going to divorce you. And leaves her husband, moves back in with her invalid dad.
That's cool.
And shows up and supports the family, and which is also, you know, a thing to be doing as a, early, like this is like 1901-ish at this point, I think. She gets a job as a journalist at the local morning paper, and she supports her family. And it's kind of a big deal because there's not a lot of women journalists in Japan at this point. She mm-hmm. starts writing fiction and nonfiction. Her real dream is to become a novelist. I really like her as a novelist, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then to continue in her like early, this is, you know, formative stuff. She wants social change, and she doesn't quite know what she's looking for. So the first thing she tries is she gets baptized Protestant and then keeps performing Buddhist rituals and just sort of does both. The Japanese-Russian War breaks out, 1904. The Christians and the socialists are the two ones fighting against the militarism. And she's a pacifist, but she starts hanging out with more socialists because they're all buds in this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the big change for her, the inciting incident, was something called the Red Flag Incident. I'm wondering if you've run across this. Every time I look at Japanese history, everything is mm-hmm. the something incident, you know, like every event.
Right.
It's really cool.
I don't.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think I know much about this one specifically. I've heard of it, but I don't really know what it is.
Yeah, and that's the thing is like, because it makes all of these things seem like really big deals. And I think they were, right? But it's just like, you know, it's like if every time we had a protest, people were like, oh, this is the, you know, the.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to tell people 100 years from now, oh, the summer of 2020 was really tense, actually.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Right, because we can't easily just call it like, you know, the.
Yeah, they're going to be like, we can't breathe. We don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's a good point. okay. So the Red Flag incident is this big anarchist and socialist rally that like shouldn't have been a big deal, honestly. I mean, it was a big rally, right? And it starts off fine. There's just lefties there. They're waving red flags. They're singing songs. They're chanting Anna, Anna, Anarchy, which is a sick chant.
Nice.
And then the police attack. And so this is why it becomes a big deal. The police attack and the crowd fights back and there's this hour-long brawl and the protesters win. They drive back the police. However, the police then round up everyone involved in the organizing of the demonstration and throw them in jail and torture them. And Suga, who was at the rally but wasn't an organizer, she goes to the station to find out what happened. She sees that everyone's been tortured, and they arrest her. So they put her on trial also. She spends 2 months in jail waiting for her trial, and she's found not guilty, but a ton of people are found guilty, and a ton of people, like huge chunks of the anarchist and the socialist movement, get sent to prison for a year or two for holding a demonstration. And seeing all this happen, right? Seeing the crowd attack, seeing people needing to defend themselves, seeing the arrestees tortured, and I'm sure being arrested herself for basically nothing. She's like, peace isn't going to cut it. Pacifism, this isn't what I'm into anymore. And she jumps over from socialism to anarchism, although all the leftist groups were pretty much friends at the time, which is sort of hard for me to wrap my head around now, but I appreciate it. And so now she's like in it. She starts dating this guy named Kotaku. She's dating a whole bunch of people during this time, which is actually kind of part of a lot of the feminist stuff that they all fight for, actually, is to be like, don't judge us based on who we date. Very nice. Unfortunately, then throughout history, people are like, oh, yeah, she's Kotaku's boyfriend. And I'm like, I mean, girlfriend, whatever. and I'm like, OK, whatever. And Kotaku, he's the guy who like brings anarchism to Japan in the first place. And
OK, yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah.
Name.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was cool.
Like, there's still a big communist. All that stuff is still pretty big in Japan in terms of like the most, you know, Western developed countries. They're kind of like leading the charge a little bit, which is pretty
cool.
Still.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Actually, I'm like, I need to learn more about what's going on currently with a lot of the stuff there. One of the problems of getting like lost in history stuff is I'm like, oh, yeah, no, I could tell you about what happened in 1920. We're talking about 1920, right? Maybe 1820, you know? Yeah. And this causes polydrama, right? The fact that she starts dating Kotaku. He divorces his wife and moves in with her. And everyone thinks she's still dating this guy who's in jail, but she's kind of over him. She's been over him for a while. And everyone's mad at her for abandoning her jail boyfriend who isn't her boyfriend. So lots of drama. And one of the things that I really like about learning about this polydrama stuff is that people get so hung up on this idea that people in the past were so different from us now and that people in different countries are so different from us. And I'm like, no, this is just the same shit, you know? Like,
yeah, absolutely.
It's just messy.
Even the jail part, I'm just like, yeah, that sounds like some people I know.
Yeah, yeah, totally, exactly. And so now she's convinced and she's an anarchist and a feminist, and her feminism isn't just, oh, she's a woman and an activist. It was very self-conscious. She wrote a lot about gender exploitation. She focused on, basically, she was mad at society for focusing on women's attractiveness. She fought back against the clothes that women were being forced to wear. And at the time, at least, so the social status of women in Japan was subordinate to men going back at least as far as the 17th century. And I'm not trying to like single out Japan here, obviously. I'm not sure, you know, like.
Oh, yeah, pretty much the whole time.
Yeah. Going back to the 17th century, there was this Japanese Confucian scholar who said women should obey their husbands as husbands should obey their feudal lord, which, I mean, it just sounds like Western, you know, all the same shit that's happening in the West, too. Widows weren't allowed to remarry. Your husband could execute you for cheating on him. The Meiji Restoration, for all its reforms, didn't really touch the status of women, and which is annoying because, as always, women were involved in the reform movement and then got left out when it came time to pass out the reforms. And in some ways, it got worse. In 1882, women were forbidden from making political speeches. By 1890, women weren't allowed to attend political speeches. So Suga, she's committed. She crews up with some factory workers. I think it might be time to tell you about something else that matters. Sophie's nodding her head. So we're supported on this podcast by a variety of sponsors. And some of the sponsors are luck of the draw, whatever, random advertisers. But we're also sponsored by Good Things. That's our plan here, is to be sponsored by Good Things. Like, for example, our primary sponsor is the concept of the potato. Potatoes are very good. Individual brands, maybe homegrown potatoes that you grow yourself. That's like the primary sponsor. But I'm wondering if...
Starchy.
Yeah.
Very solid yields, vegetable.
Yeah.
You know
what we're about.
When you're thinking about the post-apocalypse, potatoes.
Yeah, which I'm thinking about. That's basically all I think about is the 19th century and the apocalypse. So is there anything you would like to be sponsored by in today's episode? Something good and wholesome?
Yeah, I guess so. I want to be sponsored by getting randomly smiled at by a toddler you don't know. whether it's at a grocery store, whether it's at the park, whether it's at the local swimming hole. If there's a kid and they're between the ages of like 4 and 2 or whatever, and they catch your eye and then they crack you a grin, nothing better than that.
Excellent. That is our...
Is that the kind of...
That is our new sponsor.
Use promo code toddler smile at checkout.
but don't just yell toddler smile at children.
No.
Yeah, that is not the way to get the...
It doesn't count if you get it that way.
Yeah. And also these other ads.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's #1 podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, and we are back. And we are talking about how Suga is sick of being in jail and sick of a lot of things about the Empire. So
sicker boyfriends.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah. That's it comes up a lot in a lot of these things where you're like, oh, these, I like it because it's like all these women are like, I don't want to be treated by, like, shit by my boyfriend, so I will leave him.
She would have done great on Twitter. She really missed the boat. She had the socialism. She had the making fun of her boyfriends being poly. She was a woman for the Instagram era, and she missed her time.
I know. So, but she crews up with some factory workers, and they decide, they start talking more, right? They're just like talking about what's really the matter. And one of the things that they hit upon is this emperor guy, they think he's mortal, not this divine otherworldly being like he gets presented, right? And they didn't have a lot of choice in their range of tactics, because if you have a rally, you get beaten and tortured. If you start a newspaper, and for a while the socialist newspapers were fine, and that was like a main outlet they all had. But then they started all getting shut down and fined as soon as they come out.
How much of a newspaper? Was it like a zine?
You know, I can't tell, because like whenever I read about like old socialist papers and stuff, I'm like, how much is this like a literary journal and a magazine? How much is this like, you know, found a print shop?
I know that the Black Panthers had just like, it was like half like poems and stuff, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I, no matter what, if I was involved, I'd be drawing a cartoon.
All right.
I'd be contributing the least literary value for sure.
No, I mean, cartoons are very good. I hope they had cartoons in some of these. I've seen actually some of the old socialist and anarchist cartoons. They're really fun.
Interesting. I need to see some of those. I think I've seen some that are like on YouTube and they're like restored and they're just like so esoteric that I'm like, I don't get what this Russian shit is.
Yeah.
I need someone in a community college setting to explain it to me, but I'll get around to them.
I actually really like the anti ones, the like ones that are like, you know, it's the bearded immigrant with a knife and a bomb like standing behind the Statue of Liberty. And it's like, don't let these people into the country. They're going to bring in anarchy and murder us all.
Yeah, every once in a while, the conservatives in the political cartoon spectrum just draw something that is really rad and spot on.
Yeah, I like when they do our work for us.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so they're like, okay, we can't have newspapers, we can't publish our zines, and we can't have rallies. So they fall back onto everyone's favorite last resort, or maybe sometimes first resort, the bomb. And the first threat to the emperor's life actually came from 1907 from a Japanese-American newspaper in California. There was a Japanese-American newspaper, anarchist newspaper called Revolution, which wasn't called Revolution in English. It was called Revolution in Japan, which I didn't write down.
Right.
But it it published an open letter to the emperor that basically was like, so you're a tyrant and we're going to kill you. And that was their open letter to the emperor.
Cool.
Yeah, 'cause they don't really make open letters like that anymore, you know?
No.
And, you know, of course, it makes sense that they were able to do this when they're on the other side of an ocean under a different legal jurisdiction. But Suga...
What were they called? Kakume?
That sounds right.
Doesn't matter.
That sounds right.
Cool.
Yeah, I honestly, this is terrible, but I wrote down a lot of things and I wrote down the Japanese and then I was like, then more words that I don't have to pronounce. Because I don't want to... I don't like pronouncing words incorrectly. I don't feel like it's polite. So
I hear
I'm
you.
Like,
Japanese is actually really pretty easy to pronounce. It's a lot easier than people think. You just have to learn just like a couple idiosyncrasies, but essentially all the syllables are pronounced like one way. It's the only way I could speak to people, honestly. Because you kind of get it. But
it makes sense. And actually, a lot of the names in this are easier for me than a lot of the, like, when I'm, like, reading Russian names or something, I have a bit more of a hard time.
Exactly.
Huh. Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's pretty phonetic.
So they decide, they start plotting sometimes, Suga and her friends start plotting in around 1909. And it was a reasonably simple plan that they came up with. The plan was that they were going to get a bomb, and then they were going to throw it at the emperor. And then there wouldn't be an emperor.
Step one. Step
two.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, step three.
And they like they totally knew that like step four was die, right? They were like, we're not coming out of this, you know. But they were especially Suga was like pretty much into being a martyr. And I don't know if this comes from her like foray into Christendom or what, but
she was trying to get out of that poly drama.
Pretty much. You know, you're doing bad.
Like when... We all can tell.
Whereas her boyfriend, he was like, he started off being like, yeah, bombs and stuff. I'm cool. I'm a radical anarchist. I started all this. Like, I'm cool. I'm down. And then he was like, this actually sounds like we're all going to die. I don't want to do it anymore. And I can't blame him. Like,
no.
But it turns out innocence isn't enough to save you at this particular juncture, however. Hmm. So he backs out and everyone else is in. And they pretty much, they're like, all right, well, we're all friends with like miners. And you know, it's actually a fairly working class movement. You know, she herself is not particularly working class, but a lot of people in the movement are. So they're just basically go find miners. And they're like, hey, can you give us bombs? You use bombs for work. And they get a bomb and the government's on to them. So they start playing hot potato with the bomb. Like, I don't want to hold on to the bomb. You hold on to the bomb. Take it to the other friend's house. Nope, take it to this other person's house. As like, because the police are closing in on them. And then one of their friends snitches them all out.
I just want to say this podcast is not sponsored by Hot Potato.
That's right. That's right. As an example of a potato, we are not sponsored by. We are also not sponsored by snitching your friends out.
Facts.
No.
And the police raid a house. I would say we're not sponsored by the police, but I believe we have actually been sponsored by the police.
What do you mean?
They snuck on an ad.
Are they using some of their budget on on podcast?
You can like,
makes sense.
We have it like set up to filter out like politics, government, things like that. They slipped in under business.
Wow.
Which is like,
because when they arrest people, it's business as usual.
Which is like not the most shocking category they could have slipped in under, to be honest. Because
totally.
Yeah,
we protect business. Yeah.
Anyways, yeah, fuck totally. Them.
Yeah, and this is not actually ad break time. We're just complaining about our sponsors.
Yeah.
So the police raid a house after the snitchery, and they find some raw bomb ingredients, and they basically just run around and arrest all the prominent anarchists they can to try and charge everyone with conspiracy. But the police actually have a problem. All the anarchists are already in jail. They already threw them in jail for the red flag incident. And they're so upset that they can't charge these people with conspiracy. So actually, the people who got arrested for throwing the demonstration are kind of the people who survive in the end. Because they were in jail, so they were safe from being thrown in jail for worse things. Included among the arrestees are four Buddhist monks. And 26 people in the end get put on trial for conspiracy. Basically, it's Suga. Suga is actually like, well, I'm actually one of the few people who's actually doing this. The rest of the people are completely innocent. And at the end, she's like, do you have any regrets? And she's like, yeah, I don't regret trying to kill the emperor. That was a perfect and logical thing. I'm sad that this is being used against innocent people, you know?
Right. I regret
missing. Yeah, basically. Yeah, totally. I regret that you caught me before I could do this. And she actually, I mean, once she's on trial, she's basically like, yeah, I fucking did it. Or I wanted to do it, you know? Mm-hmm. And she actually talked about this a little bit at length. She was like, I'm paraphrasing here. She's like, I feel sorry that the emperor has to die. He's actually kind of nice compared to most tyrants and emperors, but he's an emperor, and so he's responsible for the exploitation of the masses, and he's got to die. The emperor, of course, had actually reached the exact opposite conclusion. He reached the conclusion that Suga is who should die.
Bias. Yeah.
And unfortunately, he had more.
Maybe there's a compromise.
I know. Maybe they could both die. Actually,
maybe they both die. Yeah.
and Kotoku, the boyfriend, he gets sentenced too. The judges and shit are all assuming it's the boyfriend in charge. And even though he had backed out of the conspiracy. And so one of the main things Suga had to like fight for was like, I'm not just a fucking girlfriend. Like, I actually am the like conspirator here. And her defense lawyer, and this just really right when I read this, I was like, I don't understand the Japanese judicial system. It does not map one-to-one to the American judicial system.
No, not at all.
Her defense lawyer believed that Suga and three of the others should be executed. That boyfriend and another guy should get life imprisonment, five more should get 5 years, and 15 were innocent. That is the defense lawyer's position. And there's no evidence for any of this crime. Wow. Besides, I mean, there's some circumstantial evidence. There's like the snitchery mm-hmm. and some bomb materials, but especially for the like wider conspiracy, there's just, they're rolling in nothing.
Yeah. That sucks.
And 24 of them get sentenced to death. So the defense attorney does not get his way.
Jeez.
And the emperor then commutes half of them to life in prison. So half of them get, well, you just get to spend the rest of your life in prison.
Wow, what a nice guy.
Really, yeah, he really looking after his people, you know? Much like the looking at who looks after their people are awkward ad transitions. This show is brought to you by awkward ad transitions. Like this one.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back. So Tsuga, and it's actually now, she's been writing this whole time. She's been writing her whole adult life. She's been writing all this stuff. She's written all these semi-autobiographical novellas, and she's, but mm-hmm. while she's waiting to die, she spends her time writing poetry and writing a diary.
Okay.
And she spends a lot of her time also reading about the nihilists and anarchists and other folks who've preceded her to the gallows across the world, and basically like finding comfort okay. in that. And the newspapers, they make this big deal out of it. They're like, look at this self-indulgent asshole, this like super vain lady who just like wants to be a martyr. And, you know, but I'm like, how could you do anything else, right? You're sitting there, you're in prison, you're going to get executed. What the hell else are you going to do? Besides yeah. like read about these other people got executed, you know?
Exactly. What else is she going to read? Romance
yeah,
novels?
Totally. And they all lived happily ever after. I wonder if she wrote any romance novels.
I mean, maybe she probably autobiographically did some about some yeah. relationships. I'm sure that's why there was some tension. She probably subwrote.
I think that's probably it. Yeah, erotic friend fan fiction gets a lot of people in trouble. You know, and so she's like, "All right, I'm gonna die. I'm gonna embrace it." She embraced it, and one of her poems was, Born in a very small land, I sacrifice my small life for a small hope. In all my reading, I read through a ton of her different, like, really, like, I guess I'm gonna fucking die poems. And, like, it's a good, I wouldn't recommend it to poets, right? But if you end up in that situation, it's a good well to draw from, you know?
Yeah, sounds very goth. I'm actually goth too, so yeah. I love that for her. Yeah.
I think most of the old anarchist poets were all goths.
Yeah, I think yeah, so.
They definitely wore a lot of black.
Yeah.
So she was hanged at 8 o'clock in the morning on January 25th, 1911. It was a week after her sentencing. It was the day after all of her co-defendants had been hanged. She didn't get told that other people had been hanged. She didn't even get told that she was going to be hanged that day. She was 29 years old, and she was the first woman political prisoner executed by the Japanese government. So she broke some glass ceilings. And her last words rule. Her last words were just, "I die for the cause, banzai."
Hell yeah.
And which is, you know, a war cry that has been used in a lot of different contexts.
Yeah. It's a badass war cry. More badass than it sounds in English.
Yeah, that's a good. Yeah, totally. Yeah, actually. I don't know if you do or not, but do you know more about that by any chance?
Banzai, yeah, that's what I think that's one of the things that suicide fighters would say when they were like flying in World War II, things like that. Kamikaze means kamikaze. If you don't know, is an extremely interesting term, very important term in Japan. It means divine wind. Kami means God, and kaze means wind. And the reason divine wind is such an important thing for them is because Japan, at several times in its developing history, was invaded by Mongols, essentially. Invaded by forces that were like huge and were absolutely going to destroy and take over Japan. And then both times those invasions happened, there were these freak huge storms that like sank all of their ships and made them retreat. And that happened twice. So they really fuck with divine wind over there.
When I like it too, right? Because it's like, okay, if this is also used the war cry for Japanese nationalists in World War II, and yet it's being used 30 years earlier by, you know, a Japanese socialist. Like, I love that. Like, I love that it's like, this is not, culture isn't the same as nationalism. You know, like coming from and participating in a culture is not the same as like, I therefore am the same as like, you know, the Japanese nationalists and imperial forces or whatever.
Absolutely. Totally.
So she's hanged and she's buried in a Buddhist temple cemetery by friends. And she's buried next to her younger sister, who had been killed a few years earlier by this thing that kills literally 100% of the characters on this show who don't die violently. That great harvester of souls, the dear friend of the pod, tuberculosis.
Interesting.
I didn't know this, but if you read history, it's just a long slew of people dying by tuberculosis. That is how everyone dies.
It makes sense. Yeah.
Suga herself, actually, during most of the time she was doing all this conspiring, was hella sick with tuberculosis.
Oh, man.
And she survived it. And, well, sort of, right? Yeah.
Sort of. Hope she didn't give it to other people. Probably
did,
honestly.
That's true, yeah. And so some historians call this whole trial a frame-up, because most of these people had nothing to do with the conspiracy, right? It was absolutely politically motivated to try and break the left. And they hadn't even made any concrete plans yet. They were just considering it. But Basuga really had been trying to figure out, like, how do we turn this guy into a puddle of blood? And I get the impression she wouldn't be much excited for history trying to claim her innocence, because one of her whole things, which will come up in the second half of the show too, is people fighting as women for the right to be like seen as powerful enough to be have committed the crimes that they committed. And so it wasn't that she was innocent. I think that it's just what she did was perfectly reasonable.
Yeah, she loves to be guilty. She's basically like a rapper. Essentially, she's got a real Tupac mentality this whole time.
Yeah, totally. Okay, and then in contrast with another one of her co-defendants, there's a Zen Buddhist monk who's an anarcho-socialist named Uchiyama Gudo, who's one of the few Buddhist leaders who talk shit publicly about the new imperialist projects of Japan, like during this time that they start their colonization of Korea. Well, I mean, they started it a while back, but start cementing it really. And this guy is cool. I really like this guy. He's only a side character in this, but I'm going to tell you about him because I like him. he confronted other Zen Buddhists who claim that you were born into low social class because of karma. He was like, no, that's nonsense, right? And he fought against corruption in the faith, like people were buying abbotships and stuff. And he was an abbot himself of a temple. Hmm. And his temple gave everything away to the poor, and they used their printing apparatus to like print papers and pamphlets for the socialists. So like if you need your zine printed, you go to the Buddhist temple. And he also wrote that the emperor was not divine, that actually, yes, he could trace back his lineage 2,500 years to a bunch of bandits who went and centralized power by killing everyone.
Wow.
And
spitting it.
I really fucking like him. And he probably had absolutely nothing to do with the bomb plot. Like most of the stuff I read is like he was completely innocent, but he had to die because he was an anarchist Buddhist. But there's another version of the story that I run across that he had a cache of bombs like ready to go. And he was like, yo, Suga, I got the bombs. Come over. I'll show you where the bombs are. You know? And I don't quite believe that one. I think it would be. He'd be a cool guy either way, right?
No, that'd be the fictional. Yeah, that's for the movie.
Totally. Totally. Yeah.
It's for the anime.
But as he walks up to the scaffold, the records say that, quote, he gave not the slightest hint of emotional distress. Rather, he appeared serene, even cheerful, so much that the attendant prison chaplain bowed as he passed. And that's just like, well, if you're going to be a fucking Buddhist monk and, you know, like, I don't know, it makes me really happy. His abbotship was rescinded by his faith when he was convicted, but in 1993, the Soto Zen, his faith, restored his status posthumously and was like, well, actually, it's really clear that he was on the right side of history on this one.
That's very cool.
And after these executions, Japanese socialism enters its winter period, just cool because it's the winter period and then it blooms again maybe 10 years later. And activists basically went into hibernation. Everyone who survived all of this was like, we're gonna take a step back and figure out what's really, how we're going to handle this so that we don't all just die. All these magazines get shut down or they start disguising themselves as purely literary journals. So yeah, like you're saying, you know, there's just like lots of poetry, lots of your political cartoons. I really appreciate that you wrote political cartoons for them.
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, just my hand at some anime, some stuff, some shonen type things. You know.
And you like hid some nice political commentary in there, but that wasn't like the point, you know?
No, it was more about the magic system.
Yeah, but, totally. Yeah. Which just weirdly revolves around explosives. I couldn't tell you why, but with World War One and Japan's involvement, the left blooms again. In 1917, anarchists formed an industrial union of printing and metal workers, the Faithful Friends Society. Soon after, another printing union was set up, study groups form, and you get this broad united front of socialists and anarchists working in the labor movement. Anarchism was kind of the only game in town at this point for radical politics. That's why I haven't like talked about communists as much, right?
Cool.
You get the Communist Party in 1922. And this is the time period where communists and anarchists really stop being friends. And this happens there. The communists run everyone out of the large labor federation. You get this Bolshevik versus anarchist split. But the crew of folks that I'm going to talk about next time, they don't really have anything to do with all of that. Even other anarchists. They're not part of the Japanese labor movement. They're nihilists and they're Korean independence activists. And again, not to build her up too much, but one of them is one of my favorite people of all time. Kaneko Fumiko.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's interesting to hear when there's like groups of nihilists. I'm just like, what are you guys?
We'll talk about it.
This doesn't matter, everybody. Thanks for coming. Let's go over the minutes of the last meeting. Everything sucks.
I mean, apparently they would have like, there's actually a movie about the next one called Anarchists from Colony. And they would have these meetings and they were like, should we do the following? I think it was like, should we go like extort some people? And one person's like, yes, definitely. And one person's like, no, we shouldn't. And then finally someone's like, well, We should each do as our own individual will desires, and those who wish to go extort people, and those who wish to don't.
I was just going to say that's interesting. That's one way you can run it. I never thought about that.
So when we come back on Wednesday, I'm going to tell you about one of my favorite love stories. And yeah, the end of part one.
So is it cool? Are we cool, Brody? What's the vibe?
Yeah.
Are we cool?
It's extremely cool. I'll be honest with you guys. I'm only imagining these people dressing in black, probably dressed like the Matrix wasn't out, but they're probably dressing a little bit like the Matrix. They've got, you know, leather jackets and like sunglasses and stuff like that.
Yeah.
At least some of them know parkour. Suga definitely learned a little bit of parkour just for reasons. Just like, we're going to parkour this bomb into the palace or whatever. I definitely wish I saw that mission go down. But very cool. You know, being a political prisoner is cool. Writing poetry when you're going to die is cool. All of this is very cool and goth. And, you know, it's got samurai swords in it somewhere. So, you know, I love it.
Yeah. Excellent.
We did it. Speaking of things that are cool and goth, do you have any things you'd like to plug?
Plug, not necessarily at the moment. I've been working on a lot of things kind of behind the scenes. So unless you're like an executive at HBO Max, I don't really have much to plug other than if you live in LA, come see me do stand up. I do it all the time. So you can check out my Instagram, AOBroBro, and Twitter as well too. That's where I mostly spend my time talking shit. And hey, if you enjoy talking shit, boy, do I do it a lot. You could also check out, if you're a huge nerd like me, you can check out my podcast, The Dark Weeb, with my friend Cody. He is like an amazing writer, writes for Marvel and stuff like that. Yeah, that's pretty much it. And just, you know, be goth and do crimes and, you know, be gay and kill people or
only
whatever.
Certain people. But yes.
I don't care.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. That's we'll be back when? What, Wednesday? Wednesday, part two?
Yes, we will be back Wednesday until the heat death of the universe. Or they change the system of dates and the days of the week. I know.
They could do anything. This Supreme Court?
Yeah.
Let me tell you.
They add a new work day to the week and they like convince the right wing that it's like, no, isn't this great? You still get a 2-day weekend, but you still get to work more.
This is good for the economy.
Yeah, exactly. Don't you want the gas prices to come down?
We're laughing, but I don't think it sounds that unrealistic.
No, it really doesn't.
It really doesn't.
No.
It was too real.
We're laughing in a way that's like,
it's going to sound quaint by the time this comes out. And they actually added 3 days to the week.
Mm-hmm.
And two of them you have to work, and one of them you're just in jail. Yeah,
jail day.
Everyone loves jail day. If you don't, you hate America.
What are you doing on jail day?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Want to hang out? No, I'm in jail. Yeah,
I can't.
Yeah.
I'm grounded.
See you all soon.
Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.